Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, blood, sweat, and data, by Premium Plus Sports, that's premiumplus-sports.com, the best travel agency around, by USA-swimrun.com. If you haven't tried a swim run event, grab a buddy, give one a try. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, last year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game alive through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, he is a multiple-time Ultraman finisher. Mr. Scott McDermott joins us. Scott, how the heck are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Wonderful. So, growing up, what were your sports?
Not a lot of them because I was awkward, not good at much. I did gymnastics for a while, and I broke my back in 1984 in that sport.
Wait. You broke your back doing gymnastics? What were you on?
The vaulting horse.
Oh, I could see that. Oh, my God. That always scares me when I watch that.
Yeah, well, it's fun when it works well.
So was it? You hit the takeoff and landed on your back?
Well, I hit the takeoff, and when I put my hands on the vaulting horse to do the press, I missed, and my fingers slipped, and then I rotated in midair and landed flat on my back facing the ceiling instead of, you know, the other way around, and I cracked a vertebrae in half and crushed the tops and bottoms of T12, L1, L2, and herniated the disc and all that kind of good stuff.
So from that, were you able to get back in the sport?
No, I never did gymnastics again. I used to be competitive in springboard diving, too, in 3-meter springboard diving.
Yeah.
Got a gold medal in that in the local, you know, state championship here. It's provincial.
Yeah,
all that ended, and I was told by 3 different doctors that I would never run again, and I'd probably be in a wheelchair by 40. So that's
always optimistic. That's nice.
Yeah, they're kind of worst case scenario guys, I guess. That's what they have to do. But I listened to those guys for, you know, a good 3-4 years, and then my back just hurt all the time, and I was just on pain meds by 19, 20, 21 years old, and yeah. But then I found a new doctor, and he said, kid, you better get in shape or your back will be that way. And I got back in shape.
and to get back in shape, were you running, cycling, swimming? What type of stuff?
I did a lot of different things. It's funny, my running background actually comes from junior high school when the bullies used to chase me home 2 or 3K, and I was pretty good at running away from them. But I got into mountain biking quite a bit, and I used to love to climb mountains, like hiking up big climbs, you know, 10, 11, 12,000 feet and stuff like that, overnight hikes and stuff like that. So I started getting shaped for that. And then when I was, so my career back then, I went to college for architecture, and I actually sat at a desk for 13 years and drew buildings. And that got me fat and sick. I was stressed and falling apart and, 230-odd pounds, and everything was a mess, and I kept going to specialists, and they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. And finally, I had a doctor, a general medicine doctor, put me through the paces and start asking me questions, and he basically came to the point where he said, you know, kid, if you don't start eating right, exercising, take care of yourself, get a little sleep, and de-stress, you're not going to make it to 40. And I went and joined a gym immediately and met a friend who was a personal trainer and just completely changed everything. And within 5 months, I had the six-pack and was back in shape. I actually can't say back in shape. I was in better shape than ever. And shortly thereafter, I realized, you know, I don't want to draw buildings anymore. I want to help people feel this good. So I quit.
Wow.
2 weeks, yeah, 2 weeks before I was an associate partner in an architectural firm, I quit and went to work part-time in a gym.
Now, were you married at the time?
I was, yeah. I freaked my wife right out.
I was going to say, that's not the best conversation. So listen, I got an idea. I'll leave this job that is paying us pretty well and is about to make me part of the management, and I'm going to go start a gym where, I don't know, most of those guys go out of business.
Yeah.
And she bought in, or was it a while?
Oh, it was a while. well. Yeah, she was pretty freaked out, and she, you know, she asked me to reconsider and stuff. But she also saw in my eyes that I had come to that point where I was living a lie and hollow.
Right, and you forget sometimes that really at the end of the day, your health is all that you have.
Yeah, well, in high school, I wanted to be a gym teacher, and my guidance counselor talked me out of it and said, "You're really good at drafting. You should be in architecture." And I was like, well, okay, you know, high school, what do I know, right?
Right.
So I went for the respectable career, you know, but I didn't love it at all. I was pretty good at it, I guess, but it wasn't what I loved to do. But helping people become fit and healthy, I love to do that. Like, so, yeah, now I've owned my gym for 16 and a half years, and it's not always easy, but I wouldn't trade it.
So it's one thing, you own a gym, and the natural tendency is, okay, we've got one, we're going to go get more, and we're going to expand, and we're going to go to different places. And did that ever enter your mind, or is it always, you know what, I've got one, and we're going to focus here?
Yeah, I thought about it a couple times, and a lot of people have asked me to open other gyms in different towns because they love our gym, and when they move away from here, they're sad that they can't replicate what we've got. But I just always wanted to do a great job of this one gym, and I could, because I'm a really hands-on guy, I
yep.
kind of do a lot of things, maybe too many things. I can't imagine, like, I work 60 to 100 hours a week. I can't imagine working more.
Oh, and I'm sure your family can't either.
Yeah. So I just want this one to do well, and I'm fine with that.
So when did this crazy sport of triathlon get into your life? Was it running first?
Well, you know, I got a little bit back into running. You know, I did the little local Terry Fox run and mm-hmm. a couple little things, you know, as things improved with my back and whatever. But honestly, it was our local small town had a half Ironman race. Start in 2004, and I kind of heard about it, and I had this triathlon thing. What is that? And it was a swim and a bike and a run. I'm like, wow, I can put off drowning, you know.
Right.
I never swam laps, but I could put off drowning. And I was a spin instructor. I loved to ride a stationary bike. I hadn't had an outdoor bike in 10 years. And running, well, I mean, you know, that's sort of coming around. Maybe I could pick that up a notch. I wonder if I could finish one of those things. And that was the idea that sparked it. And I was smart enough to go hire a coach right out of the gate. And he taught me how to swim because I was managing to swim uphill like I was carrying a brick. You know, I was quite strong on the bike in a sense. I wasn't, you know, I didn't have all the cadence and RPM drills down or whatever, but I was pretty strong on the bike. And the run started to come along, and I had terrible run form. I was a wicked heel striker at a bad crossover, whatever. I just started training and did my first sprint triathlon in May and just loved it. Like, I couldn't believe how much fun it was, and it was just a sprint, you know, it was like an hour and 10 minutes or something, and I was just loved it. And then a month later, I did an Olympic distance, and just one of the comments my wife said before, because that was my first open water swim, and, you know, my wife wished me good luck or whatever, and she commented after the race, she said, "When I looked in your eyes, I've never seen you look so alive in your life
wow.
as you did before that swim started." And she had a good point. And then the local half Ironman happened here in town. I was eighth in my age group, and at the time, Ironman Canada was still giving out spots because it filled every year. And so certain local races in our country would get an allocation of spots, much like they do for the Ironman World Championships. And I got a roll-down spot for Ironman Canada 5 weeks later. And I said to my coach, "Do you think I could finish that?" And he said, "Yeah, as long as you're not attached to the time, we can get you across that line." And my first Ironman, I think I did an 11:47, and I just was beyond hooked.
Oh, 11:47 is exceptional.
It was okay, yeah. Like, it was, you know... Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. It's 11:57. I'm looking at the poster right now.
Okay.
Yeah, it was 11:57. And yeah, I'd never run a marathon before. And it just was so far outside my comfort zone. And it filled a lot of holes, you know?
So how did that transfer when you're talking about doing an Ironman? And now you're owning a club, right? You're owning a fitness center. And mm-hmm. how did you take what you learned from that and bring that to the club in some way, shape, or form?
For sure. Doing things like Ironman and Ultraman and stuff, it definitely adds a different perspective that you can bring to your clients. So people talk about it being really hard to give up Fruit Loops or Cheerios or, you know, start eating healthy. And I have a different version of what's hard. So it just kind of enables a bit of a different conversation that you can have with people about perspective and about, if you say, well, how can you do an Ironman? How can you do Ultraman? Oh, my gosh, that's so hard. I'm like, well, actually, the race is the easy part. The training's hard.
Yes.
Every day.
Yeah.
That's what's hard. You know, the race is fun. The race is a celebration. The race is a party. You're completely surrounded by awesome. It's the training. Like, nobody sees you get up at 5:30 in the morning, go to the pool and swim for 3 hours. Nobody sees that. And then go to work, work all day, and then come home and climb on your bike and ride a bike for 2 hours in the basement. That's the hard part. And when you start showing people all the things that you're doing to reach your goal, they may not have that goal, but they can start to go, well, if you can do all that, I can do this. And it becomes a different way of relating to people, I think.
Yeah, and the cool part is, you know, you think about it, that weekend, if you're doing something like Ultraman, when you're training, nobody is following you around to give you water bottles or give you food. And on race weekend, or even when you do an Ironman, you know every 5 miles someone's handing you something. So it's way harder to do the training than it is to do the racing.
Absolutely. My training has to revolve around which route I take that has a store or a supermarket or something where I can refuel. And it's about how much can I carry on my bike. And is it really hot out? I'm going to have to find a way to carry a little more. And if you get two flats, well, you're hitching a ride home.
So how many Ironman events had you done before you heard about Ultraman or thought about potentially participating in Ultraman?
I was training for Ironman Canada 2010. So I had done 2005, 6, 7. Then I did the ITU World Long Distance Championships in 2008, 2009, one in Holland and one in Australia, back when they were messing around with whether they were doing 3K swim, 120K, they kept messing around trying to figure their groove. But so this was Ironman number 4 in 2010, and I was in Penticton having lunch with a friend named Cheryl, and she said, hey, do you mind if my friend Nick joins us? I was like, no, sounds good. And so she introduced me to Nick, and we just started chatting it up and talking about all kinds of different things. And at one point, after, I guess, hearing enough or whatever, Nick's like, "Bye, you should do Ultraman." And I was like, shut up, those guys are nuts. And he's like, it's not that bad. I won't do the Australian accent and insult people anymore, but Canadian doing an Australian is never good. But he says, well, once you get swimming, well, you can keep swimming. It's pretty easy. Somebody fed you a little bit. I was like, well, yeah. He says, and you're really strong on the bike. You could cycle forever. And I'm like, well, I've never cycled over 200. He goes, yeah, but 76K isn't that much more. A little bit of training, you can do that. And I was like, yeah, but the double marathon, come on.
Yeah.
And he says, yeah, but think about it. You do your first marathon in four and a half hours. You got 7.5, 8 hours to walk a marathon, and you'll be a finisher. And my brain just opened up to, like, hey, that's a really good point.
This guy should be a salesman.
Well, Nick Mallett is his name, and he's won Ultraman Canada, and he's done all. He's a legend in the Ultraman world kind of thing. So to him, it was obvious. Well, of course you can do it. Like, you know, he knew what kind of a, like, he, you know, just listening to me talk, he said, well, you've got all the pieces. And I signed up the next day.
for Canada?
For Ultraman Canada in 2011. And I had the race of my life. I had a 3:15 swim or something, and I had the third fastest bike split of the day on day one. And day two, I screwed up my nutrition after day one. I was so happy about being fifth overall. I didn't eat enough. Like, I had, like, a regular amount of food.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't work. And then day two, I suffered for not having enough nutrition. I still pulled off a 10-hour bike. And then day three, I ran a 9:06 marathon. I think it was...
Wow.
6 or something. Yeah. I was beyond hooked. It was just the race of my life.
And the aspect of it that is so different, because you, when you're doing an Ironman or a marathon, people who you don't know are just handing you stuff along the way. Now, when you do an Ultraman, it becomes a team event because your crew is essential, right? If you and your crew don't get along, you ain't finishing the race. You need them. They need you. Well, they don't need you that much, but you need them.
It is absolutely a team event. I've never had an experience where me and my crew didn't get along. I'm pretty fortunate to have always had good crew. My first crew in 2011 was my wife and two really good friends. And then in Kona, all three times has been my best friend, Lyle, and then my other best friend, Darren, was at two of them. And he was unavailable 1 year, so Doug Henbest from Kona filled in for that 1 year when I crashed. But, yeah, it's all about crew, and people don't get that. It's not only... It's such an amazing event that way because, like, say, when you do an Ironman, you do a marathon or any of those things, and you come back home and you tell your friends, hey, I did an Ironman. They're like, oh, cool. What's that? And you tell them, they go, well, that sounds really hard. And then they're done with it.
Right.
And you can't really explain. And even if people are intent on listening, you try to describe it, and they still go, oh. Well, that sounds hard. And they don't get it. And you don't get to share the event. But when you do an Ultraman, and your buddies are with you right there every step of the way. Like in 2013 Ultraman Worlds, we had 6-foot swells. We had a current in our face right away, just like we did this year. And I get motion sick. And so you get a couple of mouthfuls of salt water, and the gears start to reverse, and life goes sideways fast. And in 2013, I threw up for 3 hours out of the 4 hours and 44 minutes that I swam. And I crawled out of the ocean half dead. And my crew were, like, just beside themselves. But we had an agreement in place, which has stood for every Ultraman, which is you never ask me how I'm feeling. You ask me what I need. And because how I'm feeling is not relevant. And so what do you need? And I looked at Darren, I said, I need Coca-Cola straight up. And I don't drink pop. But I needed stomach acid, I needed simple sugar, and I needed a little caffeine. And he started feeding me Coke, and we got on the bike, and I felt like I was going to fall asleep for the first while. But we started to recharge and re-energize, and away we went. And cruising along the road, we were getting back on track, and we passed a few people. But then a tropical storm hit, and it was absolutely pouring rain. Like, the water was bouncing up off the pavement and hitting me in the face from below. It was raining so
God.
And I kept wiping off my garment and looking at it. You know, I wiped it and then look quickly. Oh, it's wet again. Wipe it quickly. Look. It was raining like that. And I was doing math in my head and thinking, we're not going to make cutoff. And Darren had run up to me and he said, do you need anything? I said, no, but Darren, I've been looking at my watch. He goes, you need to find another gear. And he slapped me on the butt and gave me a shove. And then my team sprinted, yelling encouragements at me for the next 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
They ran 300-400 yards, jumped in the van, circled ahead, pulled over, jumped out, walked backwards 200 yards. As I cycled past, one of them would yell and scream and holler encouragements, get to the van, and then the next guy would take over the front of the van and yell and scream for 200 yards, and then yell at me, give me a shove on the butt, and then get back in the van, circle ahead. They were there for 2 hours. And we passed 8 people, and I made cut off by like 14 minutes.
Oh, my God.
2013. And that's, to me, that's the epitome of the whole thing. It's a team effort. Like, I'm the engine, but they're the pilot. And you don't do it without each other. Like you can't gut yourself to that level and survive without that level of help. And Ultraman requires that level of help, especially this year. The bike course this year was unbelievable.
Yeah, and for people, just to refresh, the Ultraman starts with a 10K swim and a 90-mile bike day one, 171-mile bike ride day two. And this year was especially tough because it's 13,700 feet of climbing. And the double marathon in Kona especially, it's thinking if you're an Ironman person, run from Javi back to Kona. Just try to wrap your mind around that because you've ridden back from Kona and know how to run back from Javi and know how brutal that is. So since we're talking 2013, so you make the cutoff that day one, and then day two again, there's rain, and you're riding with there's a couple of you guys together. There's Adam Fox, there's Peter Hudson, Hutto, and you guys are what, about 56 miles or so from the finish of the bike ride in Javi?
And that was actually 2015, as it happens.
But 2015, right. Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, so, Hutto and Foxy had caught me on one of the gulches on the uphill. So I'm a 200-pound guy. I'm not too fast on the uphills, but I'm pretty good on the straights and the flats and the downhills. I'm a rocket. But they had caught up to me a little bit, and then we chatted as they passed, and then Foxy pulled over for a stop break. There was a little bit of a downhill, and I passed Adam. I was in the process of passing Adam. We had a little chat. He said, "Hey, mate, how many half irons have you done?" And I was like, "What? I don't know, a lot." He goes, "We've only got one left." And I was like, "Oh yeah, that's a good point." We had
56 miles. Yeah.
Yeah, we 56 miles kind of thing, and we kind of had a little chuckle about it or whatever, and then I woke up in a hospital, and it was 3 days later. What had happened is I had passed Hutto by going downhill again, because I go downhill really fast, and there was a bridge that the bridges on the backside of the island are notorious for being covered in algae.
Yep.
And it was raining that day, and yeah, that's just the way that was. I obviously corrected my steering wheel a little bit on some algae, and it slid out to the right, and we know from the damage that I put my left hand down, because I sprained all four fingers, sprained my wrist, I broke my arm in half, I shattered my shoulder in four pieces, I broke four or five ribs, they didn't really know fully. And then as I flipped, my helmet spun, because I didn't have my helmet strap tight enough, because I was one of those guys, "Oh, I don't like my helmet strap, it bugs my chin." Yeah, well, you know what? It needs to be tight.
Yeah.
It is now. But my helmet spun and exposed the back of my skull, and as I flipped over, I hit my skull on the concrete curb and broke my skull open. I also bashed my knee and wrecked a meniscus, so I was a bit of a mess.
Well, and we talk crew, but in this particular case, I mean, you're out in the middle of nowhere, right? There's
absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. Middle of nowhere on the backside of the big island, and Hutto and Adam just immediately get off their bikes, and obviously they realize this is not just a little road rash thing, and they basically saved your life.
There's no basic about it. They absolutely saved my life. Yeah, Hutto hammered the brakes and swerved around me, and jumped off his bike and ran back. Adam stopped in front, and they both got to me, and I wasn't breathing, and... Sorry, this part gets a little hard.
Yeah.
They kind of, they looked at me and they're like, "His arm shouldn't be that way. That doesn't look good." Because my arm was twisted way back behind my, where it doesn't belong. Adam's a cop in Australia, and so they kind of rolled me a little bit over onto my side enough that I started to breathe a little bit better. And by then, of course, Adam's crew and Hutto's crew had arrived and pulled over and stopped and jumped out. And Gary Wang, one of the athletes,
yep,
had jumped off his bike, and he started guiding traffic around us. There's a small bridge. And then crews just started arriving, right? And everybody just stopped everything and surrounded me. And
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then long about this time, my crew, who was just a little ways over on the other side of the bridge on the uphill waiting to feed me some nutrition, whatever, kind of were like, "Well, wait a sec. Well, how come Scott should have been here? He was cruising. Huh. I don't get it. Well, he should be here by now." And then one of them said, "I haven't seen Peter or Adam or Gary either." Because you start to learn who's around you.
Right.
Because you the crew, especially the crew vans, see each other a lot more than the athletes do. We get spread out 2 or 3 or 4 miles, and we may not even see each other if we're going a similar speed. So then they circle back, and, Lyle describes it as getting out of the vehicle and thinking I was dead.
Right.
Because I was laying on the ground in a pool of blood, and I've seen the pictures of the blood, and it was a pretty big pool. And once they got me breathing again, I actually threw up. And Hutto tells me, he says, I've never been so happy to see someone spew. He says, because we knew you'd be all right. And I started breathing a little better by then. But that was, you know, that's the thing that people don't realize. Like, those guys stayed with me for over 40 minutes in their world championships. They didn't move.
Well, the priorities change when something like that happens. It's not
sure.
About racing is less important, no. Obviously, than somebody's life. And who was it who basically put their hand on the back of your head and could feel brain matter?
That was Adam's wife, Rebecca.
Ugh.
Yeah. Adam knew, because, I mean, obviously he's a cop. He's been trained in a lot of things, first aid stuff, and he knew I was bleeding out from the back of my head. And, yeah, he tells me, he just said, Becca, I need you to put your hand here and don't take it off. And she put her hand on the back of my head, and she's described that to me. She's like, I can feel your heartbeat through something soft and squishy where there was no bone covering it. That's just not good.
No. So how long was it before an ambulance got there? You don't know, but they must have told you.
Yeah, I was told it was over 40 minutes.
And they take you to a Kona hospital, or they fly you right away to Honolulu?
They took me to Waimea, to a Kona hospital in Waimea. And, you know, they assessed a couple of things, and they knew the head injury was bad. So
right.
they air-flighted me to Queens Medical in Oahu. Or in Honolulu, sorry, which is on Oahu, I guess. But they airlifted me to Queens Medical. And, yeah, my buddy Lyle, he flew with me. So, of course, my wife is with our three-year-old. And, you know, she's waiting at the day to finish flying with their three-year-old, thinking, oh, this is going to be great. Daddy will be here soon kind of thing. And I was on pace for a record-setting day, too. You know, I was going to be 80-ish hours. And so, obviously, Cheryl and Jane are trying to get information, and information doesn't come easily, in a sense, right?
No.
They didn't know if they took me to Hilo or whether they took me to Waimea or what was going on. They finally were able to get through to my crew. And, of course, Lyle was the only crew that was with me. Drew and Doug were not. So she finally got through to Lyle, who, of course, had his phone off for a while. Other things were, you know, he rode with me in the ambulance and was in the hospital and stuff. And then they found out where I was, and so then they sent a volunteer to drive my wife to the hospital, and they said, we need to take him to Queens Medical to the brain trauma unit. He's in trouble.
And what was the diagnosis early on? Did they think you were going to make it?
Yeah, they were really worried that I had torn the bag that your brain comes in. Your brain has a protective sheathing that holds fluids in it and does all kinds of good stuff, and they were worried I had torn that, because if you tear that, it's really a problem. So once they had confirmed that in Queens that was okay, then they stapled my skull together, which is the only thing I remember in those 3 days. I remember screaming, and I could have sworn somebody with hiking boots had their foot on my head while they drilled me with a Hilti bolt or something. Like, that's the only thing I remember in those 3 days is them bolting my head together. But yeah, they were so worried about my brain that they didn't really x-ray the other parts with a lot of concern. And it turns out that they missed that my arm was broken in half. My radius of my left arm was broken in three pieces. And they didn't x-ray far enough up my arm to realize that.
Wow.
Which is a little unfortunate.
Yeah.
And the first x-ray of my shoulder, like, yeah, it looks like your clavicle's broken, but it'll be okay. But they didn't x-ray enough to realize it was actually in four pieces, and there's no way it would be okay. So we didn't discover those things till I got back to Canada.
And so at that point, and when you get back to Canada, in terms of the brain damage that you had, did you have to relearn talking? Take me through the process of, because it's been since 2015, and you were back at Ultraman 2018, but it's been a three-year journey to get here.
Absolutely, it has been, yeah. So I got back to Canada, and I knew I wasn't doing well. So we flew back to Kona. And again, you talk about Ohana, you talk about family. Jen McVeigh, one of the volunteer, helper, organizer, people of Ultraman, she set us up with a hospital in Honolulu, and she set us up with a plane flight on points to get back to Kona. Because we my wife had paid to fly over to Queens to see me when we didn't know what was going on. And one of the other athletes knew a friend who had a spot in Honolulu. So my three-year-old had babysitters and was taken care of while my wife went to the hospital. We had a couple of Ultraman people give her a ride back and forth. Like, it's so much a family. I could never even explain it all. But anyway, we got back to Kona and stayed in our little rental place for the next, I think it was 6 days or something. And I was having trouble staying awake, and I couldn't focus. I couldn't remember things. I couldn't concentrate. So I kept just drinking coffee. You know, I just thought I had a little bit of a bump on the head. We didn't quite realize how serious it was. So we flew back to Canada, and I went to see my regular doctor the next day and just said, yeah, my arm really hurts and my shoulder looks terrible and I'm tired. Can we get this checked out? He said, yeah, sent me for x-rays. So the next day I went in for x-rays, and young x-ray technician walks out of the x-ray tech room, and she says to me, my wife, she says, well, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is I know why your left arm hurts so much. The bad news is it's broken in half.
Oh, my God.
She said, I'm not allowed to diagnose anything, but I can't believe they let you out of the hospital with that shoulder. It's in like four pieces. You need surgery. And so she sent me down to the emergency room, and pretty soon I saw the orthopedic surgeon. And it's kind of funny. I always laugh about this part. Like, when you go into ER, if you're not bleeding from the neck, you wait, you know.
Right.
Right? Triage, right? So I wasn't critical. I was walking and talking and lucid, and, oh, I think he's got a broken arm. So I was in emergency for about 4 hours before they saw me. And the doctor wanders in, oh, what seems to be the problem? You know, and I told the guy, and he said, okay, I'll go get the orthopedic surgeon. And he goes off, and this other lady comes in. What seems to be the problem? You know, they're all like, you know, it's been a long day, I'm sure, right? And I told her what happened, and she goes, well, I'll have a look, just hang tight. She goes out of the room, and when she came back, like, the curtain goes, she's like, when did this happen? November 28th. She's like, that's 13 days ago. Where have you been? She goes, okay, we're prepping a room right now. We're going to fit you in for surgery tomorrow. Doesn't it hurt? Well, yeah.
Yeah, you think? Yeah.
Like, immobilized, and now they're in a hurry, right? So anyway, it was brilliant. So I got really taken care of once I got back here. So they prepped me for surgery the next day, but it wasn't until 7 p.m. so they could fit me into the rotation of all the different people. And she worked on me, I think it was close to 3 or 4 hours. So I got back into recovery room. It was almost 1 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
They put a metal plate in my arm, a metal plate in my shoulder, which have subsequently been taken out, but got me all rebuilt. But it was interesting because even the orthopedic surgeon, and you know, I've talked to her subsequently, you know, met her several times to talk about healing and things. But, you know, I asked her, I said, well, what was your biggest concern? She said, honestly, she said, I was way more worried about your head than I was worried about your arm and your shoulder. She's like, I can bolt those back together. She said, but you were slurring your speech and your eyes were not dilating properly. And she's like, I was really worried about your head. So I had a meeting with the neurologist after the surgery and some occupational therapists, and they did a couple of CAT scans. They did some deep scan MRIs, and you know, that's when they realized the level of the extent of brain injury I had. I had a hemorrhage in my frontal lobes, which is the center of all thinking and cognitive stuff, and I had diffuse axonal scarring to the whole top of my brain, which is lateral scars on your brain, which is not good. And then obviously I had an impact point damage to the base of the cerebral cortex. It just missed my vision in my hearing center. So it was pretty bad news. I went, I called a friend of mine who runs a hyperbaric oxygen therapy clinic, and I asked him, I was like, Alan, do you think hyperbaric is a good idea for this? And he's like, you bet it is. He said, you get in here as soon as you're out of the hospital. So I did hyperbaric oxygen therapy for 3 months. And I don't know if you know what that is.
You know what? I've heard of that. Is this something that you would use with scuba divers and folks like that who've had issues?
Exactly. Yeah, if you get the bends in scuba diving, they put you in a hyperbaric oxygen therapy and they recompress you. And then you breathe pure oxygen and they slowly let the nitrogen bubbles out. And then that's how they save people from scuba diving accidents, from coming up too soon. But what they also discovered is it's also amazing for people with diabetes, and it's incredible for brain injuries. Even old, old concussions can heal through hyperbaric oxygen. So, like I said, they pressurize you to what's called one atmosphere, so as if you're 33 feet below the ocean surface, and then you can breathe pure oxygen for an hour. And in the presence of pure oxygen, your body can heal really fast. Now, if you're on the surface and you breathe pure oxygen, it will kill you. But under pressure, you can do it. And my brain healed, and I came back quite quickly. And you know, again, we didn't realize how serious the brain injury was. And I remember the day. There's a lot of gaps I remember, a lot of things I don't remember, but I remember being in my orthopedic surgeon's office, Dr. Cadelli, and she's also a regular doctor too. And I was asking her, I said, well, how's my recovery doing? She had just gotten over laughing at me that I had started running 4 weeks after surgery. But I said, hey, you said I could run. She says, well, I didn't think you would. which, by the way, was the greatest feeling. I Velcroed my arm to my chest and went for a 20-minute shuffle run, and it just felt like breathing again. But anyway, I asked her at the six-week wrap-up appointment, I said, well, how's my recovery doing? How am I doing compared to other people? And I'll never forget what she said. She looked at me, and she looked at my wife, and she said, well, I don't know. I have nothing to compare to. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, I've never had a patient. She says, I've never heard of a patient. And in fact, all of the medical books say that you should be a vegetable from the injuries you have. She said, you shouldn't be as well as you are. And so you're doing really well.
Wow.
And that's kind of when it hit home, how close we had come to, you know, losing it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So after this happens... Was there ever any question in your mind that you were going to get back and get on a bike again and get back in the triathlon?
You know, my first thought, and I say this knowing new information, but my first thought when I woke up in Queens Medical was, can I finish the race? And the look in my best friend's eyes was, okay, I think something happened. That's not going to go. And, that's when Lyle said, hey, you're in the hospital and you're in Honolulu, and it's 3 days later. Now, what I found out later is, now I thought that was the first, I thought I asked him that question, and that's when I started remembering things. Apparently, I asked him that exact same question seven times. And it was only the seventh time that my hard drive was recording and I remembered it. But
wow.
My thought in the hospital in Queens was, I got to get back and finish this race. We'll get through this. You know, I'll heal up and I'll be back next year was my immediate thought. You know, of course, I got back to Canada and I knew things were a little bit different. And then the morning after surgery, when Dr. Cadelli was asking me, she said, do you have any questions for me after she'd explained what she had done for bolting parts in me and whatever? And I said, yeah, I've got one question. When can I train again? And she looked at me like, I just rebuilt you. You know, and then she gave me some stuff. She said, you know, you won't be able to swim for probably 6 or 8 months, and you probably won't be able to hold onto a bicycle for a similar time frame before your shoulder can hold the load. She's like, you can try running again in about a month. And that's when I said, so 4 weeks? And she laughed, and she goes, yeah, like about a month. So 4 weeks, and I can run? She just said, yeah. So it was always on the forefront. And like I said, once I started running again, everything shifted. Because for a month, I could only stay awake for about an hour and a half at a time, and then I had to sleep for 6 or 8 hours. I was lethargic, I was forgetful, I had no energy, I couldn't remember things. But once I started running, I went 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours. Like my being able to be awake changed so fast once I started running again. And another good thing, about 2 weeks after I started running again, my ability to taste food came back, which is a thing they don't tell you a lot about. But in a bad concussion, food tastes like, honestly, like burnt urine or poop. It's bad. Like, not that I know what those things taste like, but I know what they smell like, and that's how food tasted.
So it affected taste buds, affects pretty much all of it.
Yeah, my vision was really bad for a while. I'm left-handed, so I couldn't write. for a long time, I had to relearn how to write again, which my writing's still a bit of a mess. But I knew right away I wanted to get back to racing, and I just held on to that. And I signed up for a half marathon in May of that year. So this, after I got out of the hospital and stuff, I got back home. It was late December kind of thing. And I plugged along and got a half marathon done, and then got my medal plates out in July of 2016, and everything went well with that. So I signed up for Ironman Coeur d'Alene 2017. I love racing for a lot of reasons, but I like to think of it as throwing a rubber anchor out into the future, and it pulls you to the goal. You know, it's not who I am when I sign up for the race. It's who I'm going to be by the time I get there.
I like because rubber. The race will, rubber anchor is pretty cool.
Yeah, because it pulls you, right? You throw that out to the future, and it pulls you to that goal, and it holds you accountable. So I signed up for Ironman Coeur d'Alene 2017, and that was pulling me forward. But there were a lot of obstacles. I mean, once I got my medal out of my shoulder, I had a frozen shoulder. I couldn't lift my arm. I couldn't even lift my hand to shoulder length at all, let alone swim. So I didn't start swimming again until February of 2017, and it was a really broken swim. I couldn't breathe on my right side because my left arm would just dig me into the water. So I could only breathe on the left, and I had no power on my left arm, and it was a mess for a long time. I could hardly do anything. And holding onto the bike was really difficult. I couldn't go into the drops. I couldn't go into aero because I just didn't have the shoulder range of motion to get there. And I was going to physiotherapy every week and getting my arm stretched out, but it just was taking forever. And as I was trying to run, anything I tried to do past 13, 14 miles, my right knee would just complain for 2-3 days afterwards. And it turns out that my meniscus had been torn, and it had it healed with a fibrous cohesion to my meniscus, which was also torn. So the two of them actually bound together in one unit. And I got knocked over by a guy in a conference, and actually my knee folded over, and it ripped those two parts free from each other. And that actually set off a chain of motion where I went to a knee specialist, and he realized, oh, yeah, this is what's happened. We got to go in and fix this. So I had knee surgery end of July 2017, 5 weeks before Ironman Coeur d'Alene. But the knee surgery went really well. They cleaned up the meniscus, and the knee surgeon said, yeah, you got a chunk missing out of your cartilage, but it's kind of like a pothole. He says, like, there's not much you can do about it. I can grind up cartilage from a dead person's body and fill the pothole and cover it in a glue, but that's going to feel infinitely worse than it does now, and if that piece ever comes out, I'm going to have to rebuild your whole knee. So just tough it up there, kiddo.
What was the lowest point during this whole, again, like 3 years to try to get back? What was the lowest point?
When my knee was going bad and the guy bumped over to me in a game and I folded my knee back and I felt and heard a big tearing pop. Oh. That was the lowest point because I was finally starting to make some, well, it was one of the lowest points. I was finally starting to make some headway and finally started to think I could actually get back to this. And all of a sudden I felt like it was this huge backward leap. And if I lost my knee, then what?
Yeah, you're done. Yeah.
So, but my knee surgery went really, really well. I had a phenomenal knee surgeon. And then I crossed the finish line in the Ironman Coeur d'Alene 2017. It was a slow race. I think I was a 13:54 or something, but I didn't care. I was on top of the world. You have to be
It didn't matter, right?
No, it didn't. I was home. I was doing what I loved. I was home. I didn't care. I was so thrilled. And you have to be at least capable of a sub-14-hour Ironman to even apply for Ultraman. So I knew I had done the bare minimum to ask to go back to Ultraman again.
So the relationship with Adam Fox and Peter Hudson, when you decided to come back to Ultraman 2018,
yeah.
Obviously, you guys had, you know, you're Skyping and chatting, but had you seen each other since they basically saved, not basically, they saved your life?
No. Well, actually, Adam and his family had to route through Honolulu on their way back home. So Adam popped in to see me for a little bit. And I don't really remember that, but I've seen pictures.
Right.
And I vaguely remember talking to him. And keeping in mind, we didn't really know each other well.
No. Like, yeah, you were just competitors, right?
And yeah. Peter and I had the same coach, so I had reached out and said, hey, if you have any questions, I've done this race once before, and I kind of know the lay of the land. If you need anything, let me know. And, you know, we had talked, but we didn't really know each other well. Peter gave me a Vegemite sandwich during the day one massage, which I thought was pretty classic. An Australian gives you a Vegemite sandwich.
You didn't eat it, did you?
I did.
Oh, my God. I thought that was the worst. I was going to say it was the worst stuff I ever had in my life.
Yeah, but no, it was good. But we had chatted. And I mean, one of the things I've always said about this comeback and this recovery is that it's about way more than me, because the whole Ohana, the whole family was damaged in this crash.
Right.
Not just me. Like, Peter couldn't get on a bicycle for about a month or so. He would get his kid on and go outside and get on his bike to train, because he had a race coming up, and he was doing Ultraman Australia in May, and he would try to get on his bike and just fall apart and cry and go back in the house. So he was like, that was one of the things that I began to realize pretty early on, was every time I posted an update or posted a video or talked with those guys and they could see that I was recovering, that helped them recover. My best friend Lyle, it was really hard for him, because every time, because we both live in the same town, and every time he'd be at the gym and he'd come in and see me in my office or whatever, and we'd be walking by somebody and they'd go, oh my gosh, Scott, I heard you crashed. How was it? And I would talk about it. Every time I even mentioned it, he was instantly transported back to that moment where he dropped to his knees thinking I was dead.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot for a lot of people to come around from. So this race meant a lot more than people realize. It was closure for everybody.
What's fascinating is, I was interviewing one of our wheelchair athletes, a guy named Glenn Hartrick, who was, you know, hit by a car and paralyzed back in, you know, New Jersey, you know, it's 4 years ago. And when he was in the hospital, he was telling me he realized early on that he was the barometer for all his family and friends. If he was in a good mood and upbeat, they could sort of move on with their lives. But if he was down, then he goes, they were more paralyzed than I was. And that just sort of always stuck with me. He said he had to figure out who he could confide in, because for everybody else, he knew that, like with Lyle, if you said, God, this hurts or that hurts, he's going to go, oh my, he flashed back to the crash. And then he's sort of stuck in the moment and can't get out of it.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I realized very early on that my recovery was really important to a lot of people for a lot of reasons. Yeah. And you asked about what my low point was.
Yeah.
My low point actually came earlier this year, in 2018. One of the challenges that I had for the longest time with my brain injury is there was a delay. So between when my body did something and when my brain figured out it did it. So I would miss light switches or knock over a glass of water, or I would go out for a run and I constantly would trip on anything. I swear I would trip on the white line on the road. Where we live, there's a trail behind our house that I loved to run, and it was a disaster. Every time I would go out on that trail, I would be tripping and tripping and tripping, especially my left foot. And I just kept trying to work through it. And I met with a neurologist in fall 2017. I had to do these little drills where I had to say the alphabet backwards while I traced a moving pen with my eyes without moving my head. And I had to do all these crazy little tricks to get my brain to start working better. Hours and hours and hours and hours of drills and called smooth pursuits and saccades and all these different things I had to learn. But I had gone to triathlon camp in Arizona in February. I think it was actually early March, and things were going okay, but this was before my knee surgery. My knee was bugging me quite a bit, but things were going all right and stuff, and I was riding strong. My swim was bad, but it wasn't pathetic, so things were coming along, and I was feeling encouraged. And the last event, second last event of the camp was the trail run. We run up and into the mountains in Arizona by Scottsdale and run back down again. And I was running down the mountain with a couple of ex-pros, running fast and feeling on top of the world because I was ignoring my sore knee. And I tripped on a rock at full speed. And where I put my hands down, there were other rocks, and I folded six fingers back on my hands. And one of them dislocated, completely exposing the bone and the ligaments, and folded right backwards and was beside itself. And the finger beside it should have dislocated but didn't, which turns out was actually worse. And you jump up off the ground. I was like, I'm okay. And I looked at my hand and went, ah, swear word, I'm not okay. Because I could see
right
inside my finger. And so that was my low point. I was really mad.
Yeah.
I was so frustrated because I had just been making progress, it felt. I'd had the knee surgery. I got that mixed. It was post-knee surgery. But yeah, my knee was coming around and everything was coming up good. My shoulder flexibility was improving, and then I dislocated and wrecked my fingers.
Oh, my God.
The hospital, and they pulled my finger back together and sewed it back up and, did all that stuff. And but I couldn't use my left or my right hand. My thumb and my index finger were the only two digits I had on each hand, but my pinky, middle, and ring finger were trashed on both hands. And so I couldn't swim. I couldn't ride a bike. I couldn't really run for 2 or 3 months. And I mean, even to this day, I still can barely close my right hand. So I've still got a lot of therapy left before that comes around properly. But the good news department is in May, I actually connected with a guy named Inge Jarl Clausen, who's a Norwegian that lives in Germany, and he does something called vegetative training. And I heard about vegetative training when my friend Anaki De La Pera won Ultraman
yep.
in 2016, and then Jeremy Howard was like second in 17. I'm like, I run with these guys. Like, they're awesome athletes, but to win, something's changed. And when I reached out to them, then they talked to me like, oh, yeah, we met with Inge Jarl Clausen, and he did vegetative training, and it helped me get through some mental stuff, and it really helped me breathe better and all this kind of stuff. And so I reached out to this guy, and I actually went to Germany for a week and he does all these therapies where you're breathing and you move your arms in a certain way, your shoulders in a certain way while you're breathing a certain way. And he does all these different things. And I did that therapy with him for a week, and the change in my ability to know where my body is in space and where my feet are was unbelievable.
That
made a huge leap forward in that, and that gave me sort of renewed hope. And then, yeah, I just sort of got back to the business of therapy every couple days to get my fingers to work again. And, pretty soon I could hold onto a bike and steer it safely. So out we went and off we went, and just became a process again.
And then you get off the plane in Kona, and you're back at this place just a couple weeks ago, where, worst moment of your life happened. How, getting off the plane, what was going on? I'm guessing you had a little butterfly action happening.
My eyes got a little wet.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Just pure joy. Just coming off that, the first smell of that Kona moist, humid air, I just was beaming. I was so happy to be back. Yeah. It was unreal.
And then you, even though you'd been in contact with these guys, you see Hutto and Foxy for the first time in, since back then, since basically in 3 years. That had to be pretty emotional.
Yeah. Yeah, that was unreal. Lyle and I were out for a bike ride, and Hutto's plane came in a little bit early, so we just circled off the Queen K and went to the airport. And he walked up, and I mean, that's one of the hugs for the ages. Like, it's just, yeah.
That's so cool.
That was something else. I could never, ever describe how great it was to see him again, and I think how great for him to see me. Yeah, two grown men crying at the airport, but whatever. It was awesome.
So you get through day one. The swim was this year was tough, right?
Yeah.
But day one, you get through day one. Day two, with the 13,700 feet of climbing and 171-mile bike ride, there was a lot of people who didn't make that bike cutoff time. Were you concerned about that?
Yeah, I definitely was. Sorry, my six-year-old just popped into my office. He wants to say hi.
Hey!
Yes?
The dance is coming up soon.
Okay.
If you want to come to the dance, you should probably get downstairs now.
Okay, we'll finish up quickly. Thank you so much. So
my son's in grade one, in the first grade, and they're having a dance tonight, so he wants me to come and
absolutely.
Be a little bit adaptable. No, we're good. I've still got a little bit of time.
Okay. So, Ray, that second day when it was so brutal.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fascinating things about the race this year. I think a lot of people that race Ironman, Ultraman, and stuff, they're kind of broken mentally, in a sense. And I don't mean that like, you know, people always say, you're crazy, and that's funny. But there's a lot of people, and I was one of them, where we get something from the race. And in my case, it's sort of trying to prove to my family that I'm worthy. And so I would go out and the more I suffered and the more I hurt, the more they would realize that I was good enough, kind of a thing. And that's some of the stuff I was working through as well with Inga, is that mental piece. So there's the deep, deep, deep crazy theory that on some level I attracted the crash because of a broken psychological need to hurt. And I know that gets a little deep, but that was gone this year. I didn't feel the need to hurt beyond what the race already gives you, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah. So I raced this year at peace. I wasn't trying to prove anything. I wasn't trying to be good enough for somebody. This had nothing to do with anybody. This was a very personal journey of enjoying the race and enjoying the fact that I can race again. And it was bliss. And yeah, that day two bike course, we called it the Dream Crusher. It was really friggin' hard.
Yeah.
Like I said, I'm a big guy and at 200 pounds, like 13,700 feet of climbing. Like we climbed Saddle Mountain Road for 3 hours relentlessly. And all you can do is just keep grinding. I changed my rear cassette to an 1132, and boy, I needed all 32 of those gears. And it was just about stay steady, keep climbing. And I ripped on the downhill, which was great. Sorry, just one sec, Bob.
Sure.
Dad?
Yeah.
We have to go to the dance in 0 seconds.
Okay. You know what? You guys run ahead, and I'll catch up to you.
Okay. I hope you don't miss the dance.
I won't.
We only have so little time left.
Okay. I love being a dad. It's my favorite thing in the world, so I apologize for the interruption.
Not a problem. Love it.
It's real for me, but... yeah, so, but then I downhill really fast, right? I was going, I don't want 80K an hour in
yep.
America.
You're going fast.
0.6, 50 miles an hour. So I downhill at 50 miles an hour. But the problem is if you do the math, your wattage and power output and your weight and your in the hills and the inclines, I punch it all in. I mean, I gained 10 minutes back, but I lost an hour and 30, you know, climbing.
Right.
So the math never works out in your favor being a big guy on those big hills. But, we got to the far side of the island, Hilo, and it was just the pressure's on. So I was just hammering as hard as I can. And I knew, like, the guys went pretty quiet. They got kind of serious. Like, Lyle and Jochen Dembeck, they got pretty quiet, pretty, not blunt, but very focused. Because they were doing the math, especially Jochen. Jochen Dembeck is... He's been in this game for, I think he's done 10 Ultramans. He's been racing since the 90s. And he hurt up his knee pretty bad last year, so he wasn't racing. And in the spring, he offered to be on my team. And I mean, if you can have a 10-time Ultraman guy on your team, you just say yes.
Right.
Plus, he's an amazingly wonderful guy. So, but they weren't joking. They weren't being fun. They weren't being funny. They were quite serious. And I it took me a bit to realize that they were concerned about cutoff, and justifiably so, as we ground our way through the backside of Hilo, which on any other given year, that's when the race starts. That's when the work starts. And we had already done a lot of work. So it was that kind of a day. Like, it was pushing and pushing and pushing. And we ripped past the bridge, the fateful bridge, and the guys were all stopped there. And we all kind of just had a nod as I zipped past the bridge. But not too long after that, my stomach basically started to tell me to bugger off and stop putting things in it. And, you know, then it's a different game, right? It's, okay, how do we find something I can tolerate that's not going to make me throw up because I need fuel? You can't do this on nothing.
Right.
And so we started to climb out of Honoka'a up to Waimea, and it started to rain, and the wind started to blow, and I was empty and exhausted, and here we are again. You know, and Dan said the same thing. He's like, you bugger, I do not want to do this again. You need to get moving. And, yeah, I'm doing the math, and I'm going, okay, I'm going 6 miles an hour, and I've got way too many miles left for this to happen. And just digging, and then you find a new gear, and you find a hole, and you dig into it. And, you know, at one point, Jochen says, you know, how's your stomach? And I said, it doesn't matter. I don't have the luxury of caring. We got to go. And, we just, everybody, you know, the guys did a couple of sprint runs behind me cheering and stuff, and then at one point, I pulled over to the side of the road because I had to pee for about 2 hours, and it was just getting too painful to ignore. So I did that. And then Darren had a chocolate milkshake, and he's like, do you want some of this? I'm like, sure, I'll try it. We call it the food lottery as athletes. We call it the food lottery. And, you know, when your body gets really upset, like in the back of the van, we have drawers. So there's intended food, maybe not so intended food, optional food, and DEFCON 1 food. And you know what? We were past DEFCON 1 food. So he hands me a chocolate milkshake, and by golly, that was probably the best thing I've ever drank in my life. And I drained half of that thing in a heartbeat. And somehow it rallied my energy, and for whatever reason, it felt good. And then they threw me a couple of pieces of malasada shortly after that, and I just started smashing down the pedals and grinding up the hills. And once I got into Waimea, where it kind of flattened out a little bit, I dropped the hammer. And I was riding, I just have to do math because I know kilometers, 0.6. I was going, I got to divide by ballpoint. I was going 25, 28 miles an hour for the next 2 hours. Like, I just flew through Waimea and down the hill towards the highway and made the right turn up to towards Javi. And we got to the finish line on day two in the dark by, I think it was 11 hours and 24 minutes or 7 or something like that. We made it.
You made it by what, about a half hour or so?
By about a half hour, yeah.
Ah, you killed it. Come on. No problem.
Well, we made up time. Yeah, we did. We went from we're not going to make it to we made some time. But it was the whole crew pitching in to make that happen. Like, that was, yeah.
So, what's fascinating is Rob Gray finished the ride that day, the second fastest ride of the day. And afterwards, his Garmin basically said, you need 4 days off. You need 4 days of recovery. And you guys got to get up, basically, and you got to be running a double marathon in 12 hours, not three, not 4 days. And so the next day, and at this point, I'm guessing you're just loving every second of this because you're able to do it again. And it was almost, everything was almost taken away. So running that double marathon and finishing that race that you know, 3 years that in the making, what was the feeling like at that finish line? And you had a big old Starbucks something waiting for you at that finish.
That's right. Yeah, a venti mocha frappuccino.
Well deserved.
And I don't even think I stopped to breathe, and I drank that whole thing. Yeah, Bob, that was the most amazing experience. Like the first half marathon, I think I floated. I don't even think I ran. I just floated at a beautiful pace. And the sun, it was raining a little bit in the morning. It was nice, actually, and watching the sun come up. And I stopped more often this time, all 3 days, and looked around and looked at where I was and soaked in how it felt to be there and all the people. And I enjoyed it more than I've ever enjoyed a race. I just was more present to everything. And yeah, it got hard, right? It started, you know, temperature goes up and now it's 100 degrees and you know, your feet hurt and they're sloshing around in wet shoes because you're pouring water on your head. And, you know, it's all the things that a double marathon is. It was hard. And I got to the point at about 40 odd miles where the pain was so severe in my hips and my knee that's been damaged where I couldn't block it out anymore mentally. It was just, I couldn't block it out. Usually I can deal with it, but it was like, okay guys, I can't shut it off anymore. And I was slowing down. And I said, I think it's time for a little bit of Advil. So I took a couple of Advils, which I don't love to do during races because it's hard on your liver and your liver's already busy, but in this case, I just needed everything to shut up so I could keep going. And so it's funny because you look at my Garmin splits and you can tell where I took the Advil because 15 minutes later, my splits got faster every mile for the next while. And then, so yeah, it was a bit of a slow double marathon, but we crossed the line in sub 11 hours and everything just kind of feels like it goes into slow motion for a second and goes quiet and you just run down that chute and it's just bliss and everybody's there. And because I'm a trainer, we all dropped down, did 5 push-up burpees.
I saw that. Yes.
Yeah. The first one hurt like hell, but yeah. And then, you know, the hugs, like the second we crossed the finish line, my group all turned to itself and we all hugged each other, you know, and just bawled. It was something else.
Yeah, and then you had Adam and Peter were there.
Adam and Peter were there, and they waited. And there's so many people that were part of that big fateful day were there. Sherry was my paddler. She was on scene the day. Gary Wang was there. Tara Horton, the lady that won the overall females, she actually waited around like a couple hours for me to finish. You know, we had a big old hug, and It meant a lot to a lot of people to get that done.
It really did.
Cheryl and Jane and David too, right? That was a big deal.
Big time. Well, it's a family. That's what's so special about Ultraman and having one of their family members come back after being gone for 3 years and seeing that you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Of all your finish lines, was that the best?
Oh, that's a big question. I would say no, because they're all different. My first finish line, my first Ironman in 2005 was big. That
right.
was huge on so many levels. But this is, that's a tough question. They all mean so much, Bob. They really do. Like, my first Ironman Canada was amazing, or Ultraman Canada was amazing. My first Ultraman World Championships in 2013 was amazing. But this is definitely, I actually would say this is number two. Yeah.
Love it.
Like my first Ironman and this one.
Love it. Hey, Scott, first of all, I don't want to keep you from the recital tonight because I think that's going to be pretty cool. But second of all, just being able to watch your journey over 3 days and seeing, you know, how much love there was for you and from you. That made this Ultraman really, really special. And those are the racing and the bikes and the run, the swim. That stuff's great, but it's really that passion and compassion that that separates Ultraman from anything else that I cover. Ultraman is very, very special.
Yeah, I agree. I got a little flustered at the awards dinner because I didn't want that moment to end because you wait so long for it. And looking around the room at everybody's faces and all the athletes and the crews and the support, and you just want to soak in that and stay there. It's an amazing group of people.
Love it. Hey, Scott, thank you so much for taking so much time. It was really a pleasure to get to meet you over there, and to hear your story from you is really, really special. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. Well, and the exciting thing, I think one of the really cool, exciting things about this journey is that we captured it on film. We got this crazy idea in 2015 to make a documentary about the journey for an average Joe Schmo to go to an Ultraman, because we thought that was kind of neat. And then the rules all changed, and the film became about something else. And so we continued recording the movie for the 3 years of recovery and doing little GoPro clips here and there. And we've interviewed surgeons and doctors and physiotherapists and, you know, the mayor of our town and people that were affected by this. And then during the whole weekend this year at Ultraman, we've interviewed all the people that it's impacted. We interviewed Steve King, the people that were there, the people that were first on scene. We've interviewed Adam and Peter and got their story right from them. And then, of course, Drew filmed the whole race as it unfolded. And so we're putting a documentary into the Banff Mountain Film Festival this year. We're hoping the film will be out in August for pre-screening or whatever, and then launched with the Banff Mountain Film Festival, which I think is in October. So I'm really excited to share that with the world and to inspire other people. That's always only been my goal, is to just to inspire other people and show them, hey, I'm just a regular guy. I'm no different than you. So this is what can happen if you set a goal and reach for it.
Love it. Cool. Well, the time is right. Let's do another radio chat to talk about when the movie's coming out, and we'll do it up and promote the heck out of it. We have a film out called We Are Triathletes that we've been traveling. Actually, just launched in Germany last week in 24 theaters. Had 1,700 people there. We've had about 19,000 around the world so far. So, yeah, I've got a handle on distribution. So I'm happy to help you guys with that.
Yeah, we tried to get that film to play here in our local city, and we couldn't get enough people prepaid to make it happen. A little sad.
Remind me, I'll connect you with the folks at Demand Film, and you can talk to them about having them distribute, because they have deals with all the theaters around the world. And
that'd be awesome.
Yeah, happy to. All right, Scott McDermott has been our guest. Again, we're brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series, VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, Polar, Blood, Sweat, and Data, by PremiumPlus-Sports.com, USA-SwimRun.com. Grab a buddy, try a swim run this next year. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation, 25 years we've been around. We've sent out 23,000 grants and raised over $100 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.